Peter, there's a chair there. And there's some over there if you have to leave early.
I have a question. Is he going to stay pretty much at the podium?
Or? I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, I've heard him speak at Harvard because I used to work at Harvard, but I can't remember because
what his behavior is there.
Yeah, I can open it up because obviously, you know, it's going to be a still shot. So well, I have it at the podium now. And,
how firm is it? What is the? Where's the wide?
Right here.
Okay, I'll come and I can. I know enough about it to make it. Okay.
You push it up, it's wide. You push it down. It's,
thank you.
So you're recording now.
Thank you very much.
Okay, and I'll be back in an hour.
Thank you.
Okay, you're welcome.
Good afternoon. This is a great turnout. I thank you all for coming. My name is Greg Fried. I'm the chair of the philosophy department at Suffolk. And it's my pleasure to welcome you to the first in the Pearl Lecture Series in Philosophy and Public Affairs this year at Suffolk. I'm going to speak very briefly because Nir Isakovitz will be introducing our speaker, who is Glenn Lowry, speaking on the question, Are Black Americans a People? We will be serving dinner, a buffet dinner, after this event, Thai food, if that means with your approval. So I welcome you to stay, but there are more of you than we expected. So may I see a show of hands for those of you who do not expect to be staying to eat. Whoa. Okay, wait, again. So I need to order food, more food if it's necessary. Hands up if you're not staying. Whoa. I think we'll be fine. Okay, thank you very much. I will say very briefly one word. Nir Isakovitz is the newest member of the philosophy department. He started just this past fall. He has a JD and was a practicing lawyer before he saw the light and turned to philosophy. He received his PhD at Boston University, and his specialty in our department is the history of ethics, applied and professional ethics. So it is very fitting that he introduced Glenn Lowry, whom I've known myself since my days at Boston University as well. So, Nir, please.
Good evening. Thanks for coming. My name is Nir. I'm the first member of the philosophy department. I'm very excited. Glenn Lowry, professor of social sciences and professor of economics at Brown. Before teaching at Brown, he's taught at BU, Harvard, Northwestern, University of Michigan. He also held a position at some of the top research universities around the world, from Oxford to New Delhi. His BA is in mathematics, and it's from Northwestern, and he has a PhD in economics from MIT. Professor Lowry is a very distinguished, well-known academic economist. Varieties of areas like welfare economics, game theory, industrial organization, natural resource economics, and the economics of income distribution. His books include One by One, From the Inside Out, Essays and Reviews on Race and Responsibility in America, Free Press, that won the American Book Award, and the Christianity Today Book Award, Anatomy of Racial Inequality, from the University of Paris, which I had the pleasure of teaching last year at BU. Social Mobility and Public Policy comparing the U.S. and the U.K. from Cambridge in 2005. In addition to his scholarly work, Professor Lowry is also a prominent social critic and public intellectual. He's a frequent commentator on NPR and television, and was for many years a contributing editor at the New York Public. He currently serves on the Editorial Advisory Board of American Interest and is a member of the Council of Foreign Relations. Glenn is the recipient, among other distinctions, of the Guggenheim Fellowship, Carnegie Fellowship. He's a fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, and a fellow of the Econometric Society, vice president of the American Economic Association. And among his other distinctions, he helped me get my first job out of graduate school. We're grateful and honored that Glenn could join us tonight to talk to us about whether Black Americans are people.
turnout. Pleased to be here at Suffolk. I want to start with a couple of quotations. This is W.E.B. Du Bois in 1903, The Souls of Black Folks. The shadow of a mighty Negro past flits through the tale of Ethiopia, the shadowy end of Egypt, the Sphinx. Throughout history, the powers of single black men flash here and there like falling stars and die sometimes before the world has rightly gauged their brightness. That was Du Bois in 1903. This is the culture critic Stanley Crouch in 1995. The periodic hysteria about Africa's role in the beginning of civilization is a response to the fact that our level of intellectual engagement on the grand stage of the world was quite humble throughout our tragic arrival in the Western Hemisphere. No shadowy flitting around Egypt or Ethiopia. That humble level was the result of an environment as far removed from the bustle of intellectual cultivation as the world of the most distant rural peasantry in Europe. That's Stanley Crouch, 1995. Okay, so I have a text, I'm going to read it, but I want to motivate you first as to what it is that I am about here. The title is provocative, Are Black Americans a People? So you may think you're getting ready to hear a political tract, some kind of harangue. I'm going to go off on some kind of partisan argument about this or that. I'm going to have some scapegoat that I'm going to set up, you know, some straw man I'm going to knock down black. And that's not really what I'm about. I want to reflect seriously on the question. I think it's a very, very important question. And it's not a question of fact. The argument I'm going to make here is the approach that I'm taking to this issue. Things that I'm concerned about here are not about facts. I'm not asking you, or I'm not putting before us the issue of, do black Americans have these or those attributes which some notion of peopleness would require, and therefore we can infer that there are people. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the normative question. Should we so construct ourselves? Is that the modality of discourse that we want? Do we want people talk when we talk about black Americans, when we talk about the issues, when it's relevant to even mention that somebody is black? Whenever that comes up, whenever the question before us has a racial aspect, should we be thinking in people categories as opposed to something else? We have these people, we have those people, we have the Italian Americans, we have the Jews, we have the blacks, etc. That's the way we're supposed to think about it. This is not a sociological inquiry. I'm not asking who marries whom. Okay? I'm not doing genealogy. Understand? I'm talking about language. How do we want to talk about ourselves? My question. Is people talk helpful? That's my question. Okay, so am I clear? Now, the answer is not obvious. I think there is certainly a case to be made for people talk. I've engaged in some of it myself. I mean, you know, it's easy to belittle as backward or benighted, unenlightened, the Afrocentrists who talk about the ancient Egyptians and that they were black. I mean, this is one sort of fanciful, sort of mythic dimension of this people talk. But I mean, of course, the people are going to have a narrative, right? We're going to be a people. We're going to have a story. It might as well be that the ancient Egyptians are our ancestors and that they were great, since as stories go, that one is neither any more or any less valid than a lot of the stories that I'm hearing peoples tell themselves about their ancient ancestors that justifies their contemporary actions on behalf of their peoplehood. That story is, as far as I'm concerned, just as credible or just as lacking in credibility from a scientific, historiographic, sociological point of view, archaeological point of view, from a point of view of the facts, of the objective actual things that happened. That story, the ancient Egyptians were black, the pharaohs, Cleopatra, that's our legacy, that's our heritage. Why not? We're making it up. Why not? Okay. Mind you now, it's easy to belittle them because it's a transparent anachronism. I mean, it would have been an unintelligible claim to the ancient world that if you went up to one of these pharaohs and said, you're black, he would say, what are you talking about, man? I mean, we're just projecting back categories that are relevant to our lives onto these things when we're doing this, right? So it's easy to refute the claim, I mean, Cleopatra was black. Mary Lefkowitz, the distinguished classicist at Wellesley, wrote a whole book about refuting those kinds of claims. I mean, it's very persuasive. Not out of Africa, which was in response to Martin Bernal's claim that Greek civilization rested upon Afro-Asiatic foundation. Well, no. Anyway, it's easy to belittle that, but we ought to think about it for a minute, because those people who made up those stories, I mean, there's a whole history of, I'm talking about Afrocentrism, I'm talking about this in the context of peoplehood and people talk. Talking about ourselves as a people. So now, should African Americans think of ourselves as a people? That's my question. So it's in that context I'm talking about this kind of cultural invention, you know, where African American culture and stretches back to Egypt and all of this. And I'm saying, if we're going to have a narrative, that doesn't sound like a bad one to me necessarily. It's not obviously wrong. We could have an argument about it. But that the criterion for judgment wouldn't be archaeological or historiographic accuracy, because it's all being made up anyway. Kind of thing like that. It's easy below those people, but they didn't have a choice but to be black. The people who made up those stories were black not by descent, not by election, not by tradition. They were black by imposition. Talk about slavery and the edifice that had to be built around slavery in a society that's freedom-loving in order to make it go down. I mean, you guys do know that this republic rests upon a slave foundation. It's in the Constitution, not the word slavery, just the necessary legal protections for the institution of slavery. They're in the Constitution. How do I get my property back if you cross the state lines? Before the states could agree that they were going to have a union, they had to resolve that one, and they did. It's in the Constitution. And yet we're the land of the free and the home of the brave. I mean, the powerful national ideology is freedom. So how do you have slavery right in the center of freedom? By making into non-people the subjects of the slave traffic. They can't be citizens. I mean, not just as a matter of law, but as a matter of their essence, they can't be citizens. Because were they fit for citizenship, your whole narrative collapses. Talk about the 19th century. But I'm talking about our own intellectual precursors. I'm talking about the foundations on which we stand. So these Afrocentric romantics who invented all these stories about Egypt, the guys du Bois, a great man in their sway. I mean, his eyes are rolling around in his head. He's talking about Ethiopia and sphinxes, which is unbefitting of a man with a Harvard PhD and a postdoctoral fellowship at Heidelberg. Maybe the postdoctoral fellowship at Heidelberg explains why his eyes are rolling around in his head, if you get my drift. Yeah. I'm talking about romantic European 19th century nationalism. Understand what I'm talking about? We're still living with the consequences of those mythic... anyway, I digress. Du Bois, influenced by certain ideas, by people who did not have a choice but to be black, and that was really the point that I wanted to come to, their romance on behalf of this notion of peoplehood was to some degree forced upon them by the existential dilemma created by their situation. And their situation was that their basic human worth was being questioned, and as I've argued here, the questioning of their basic human worth is an inescapable consequence of the juxtaposition of an ideology of freedomhood, individuality, and liberty on the one hand, and the social historical reality of chattel slavery on the other, cheek by jowl, right up against each other, same constitution, same people, same myths, same national anthem. I mean, I could go on about that for quite some time, but that wasn't really my point. Easy to dismiss these people. Are black Americans a people? I'll give you a hint. I'm going to say no. Okay, but before I say no, I want to acknowledge that the pull, the yearning, the search for dignity in a place, the search for a way to stand proud and look the man in the eye and say, yes, I'm a man too, We can all understand that, can't we? Alex Haley, Roots. Roots. This was a big cultural phenomenon in the United States in the late 1970s. It was the national number one bestseller in 1977. That is what my text says. There was a television series that ran for a week and was watched by millions. This was a man who told the story of Kunta Kinte, who had been his ancestor, he said. He had discovered his ancestor. He had traced his ancestry back to Africa. The first African of his ancestry to have set foot in the United States, he alleged, was Kunta Kinte. The village that Kunta Kinte come from, Jafure, J-U-F-U-R-E, he went to, the cameras went to, and the story was told about Roots. Now, it turned out that he made it up. I'm not making that up. I got documentation for that. It's fairly well accepted. Not only that, but then he plagiarized a little bit too. But this is not a slam at Alex Haley. I'm talking about peoplehood and the invention of peoplehood. Right? The social production of peoplehood. Not to wax too postmodernist, but you see what I'm saying? I mean, peoplehood isn't given. It's not a thing. It's something we're making up. So I'm talking about the making up of peoplehood. Black peoplehood. And I'm talking about Roots. So Alex Haley made it up, but the truth of the matter is that any African-American telling that story would have to make it up. Any African-American trying to tell the story of how his people came to the United States would have to make it up, because they did not write memoirs. We don't know what was going on amongst the slaves before 1830. Despite many generations of very fine historians who have examined what documentary record remains, we know very little about how they saw their world. They spoke a jumble of languages. They were just thrown hither and yon. It was a Holocaust. That's not a metaphor. Okay? Now, whatever comes out of that is not going to be contiguous with what went before. It's not going to be a straight line derivative from what went before. It's going to have to be made up in part, because nobody knows. We're a people in some sense without a past, to the extent that we are a people, that is, African Americans are a people. And remember, I'm going to come around to arguing that we ought not to be talking like that. To the extent that we are, we'd be a people in some sense without a past. We didn't exist before the Holocaust of slavery. A myriad peoples existed, but no African American people existed. So Haley made it up, but you can't really blame him, because any African American would make it up, and you can't really blame, which is my point really, the millions who flocked to the bookstores and to their television screens, and now even on DVD, you can still get it, to be enraptured by the story. A man going back to this village and finding his roots. I understand that African Americans are all over Ghana. I mean, I'm sorry, that did sound a little bit divisive. And I didn't mean it to. People are going home. Big fight about the castle on the coast where slave trading had actually taken place, where almost like shrine, like sacred ground, government wanting to do one thing, tourism being a factor, African Americans feeling very much that ought to be left exactly the way it is, having to some extent a voice about what would be done, because this is sacred ground, because we have to preserve the memory. Again, I don't want to seem disrespectful to this. And I'm not the most qualified person to engage in some disquisition on, you know, the moral significance of the fact that they were traded on the coast to the Europeans. They had to be brought from the interior by Africans. The irony, of course, is that Jafure, the village from which Kunta Kinte is said to have emerged, was a slave trading village. It was much more likely that his family was on the sending end of the slave trade than being a part of the slave trade itself. So again, argues the critic of Alex Haley. But I'm not here to make a whipping boy of Alex Haley. I'm just trying to say the invention of this peoplehood, the search for a past, the search for dignity, this creation of a narrative, of a place to stand. You can understand why people would be doing it. The slaves were a profoundly dishonored people. They were sambos. They were the subjects of minstrel show. They were, even by those who labored on their behalf, it was the great Abraham Lincoln who said, and I paraphrase, it's not an exact quote, but it's close, that I argue for a woman not to be my slave does not mean I argue for her to be my wife. He said that in the Lincoln Douglas debate, and he had to say it. I'm not asking for social equality, said the great Abraham Lincoln. I just want slavery again. Who would have wanted her for his wife? Well, evidently quite a few wanted her for his concubine. Status, hierarchy. Honor and dishonor in a society, an institution of trafficking in human beings. It's accompanied by a system of honor, by a kind of superstructure of idea. It's not just legal property relations that are at stake. Orlando Patterson demonstrates this quite powerfully in his book, Slavery and Social Death. He demonstrates that slavery is in the main not a property relation, like owning the contract for a football player that you could buy or sell if you were owning a football team. Buying and selling their labor services, one team to the other, then the player is a piece of property or treated as such. That's not what slavery was, because the football player can still be an honored symbol in the society. He's still an elevated figure. The slave has to be, says Patterson, if it's to be slavery, degraded, dishonored. Right. The African Americans were dishonored. Our problem in the century and a half, since the middle of the 19th century, has largely been about the achievement of an honored place to stand within the larger social framework. It could be argued. What is lynching? I'm talking about the ritualistic communal murder and mutilation of a human being. This is what I'm talking about. It's an enactment. A lynching is a dramatic performance by a community. The victim is hunted down. The crowd will come to the square. On some occasions, families came. They have photographs of wagons and kids playing and picnic blankets spread. I'm not making this up. This is American history that I'm talking about. And so the one who's accused of the unforgivable act, the raping of the white woman, of course, is the sort of extreme epitome of this thing. Whether he did it or was only accused of having done it. But it needn't have been that. He might have just been too uppity in the general store. He might have just had too much land. He might have just told some white man who was trying to cheat him to go to hell. He might have failed to step down from the sidewalk when somebody was coming toward him. He might have looked at somebody the wrong way. They've been lynched for reckless eyeballing in this country. That's what it's called. When the black young male allows his eyes to linger too long on the bodice of the white young female, that is called reckless eyeballing, and you could have lost your life for it in Georgia or Alabama or Arkansas or Tennessee or Indiana or Ohio or Texas, et cetera. Okay? I'm just trying to make a point here. That the African-American was a dishonored person within the larger American context for a century after the end of slavery. and that the subjugation that was slavery was not what that shows, what that illustrates to us, is that the subjugation of slavery was not in the main about the law. Of course, the law was a handmaiden to something else, but it was also about the social construction and the social endorsement of status and of meanings, of what it means to be degraded in a society. The reason that blackface works, again, I don't know what you people may know about the history of American culture. I'm talking about the actor smearing the face with something like shoe polish until it's black, black, black. The lips are red. The eyes are left white. He comes onto the stage. It's vaudeville. It's ribald. You know, there's sexual innuendo. He enacts some thing, whatever it might be. It always comes right up to the edge of the permissible. Right up to the edge of what could possibly be shown in public. And he finds cover. He's able to assume these characterizations and enact these actions only because he blackens his face. In other words, he evokes in the audience a memory. It's a virtual, it's a cipher. It's not actually a person. No one is that black. No one's lips are that red. Do you see? Do you see what I'm saying? It draws on a cultural reservoir of stigma associated with the Negro by hyper-Negroizing what might have been an Irish ethnic actor on some traveling show in 1910 or 1880. Hyper-Negroizing, my word, but you see what I mean. In order to get cover, to be able to put his hand under the skirt or fart in public, I don't mean to offend you, but I want you to understand what I'm saying. This is proof of the stigmatized subliminal beneath the surface of the society's consciousness. The meanings that are being drawn on in this kind of dramatization are telling us something about what blackness is in the society. This is the problem that people are facing. I'm talking again about, are black Americans a people? My answer is no. Trying to get you to understand me as I come to that answer. That's what this lecture is about. I have said I'm not without sympathy for waxing people-esque. I can understand how people would get to that position, how a man like Du Bois could get to that position. I'm not without sympathy for it. And certainly the search for dignity, the quest for a place to stand, a narrative. I'm as great as you. What do you mean? We also had airplanes or helicopters or calculus. Or astronomy. I mentioned Mary Lefkowitz, and I admire her. But she says in that book, Not Out of Africa, at one point, she objects to the Afrocentric mythologizing about the African origins of Egypt because it robs the Greek people of their heritage, as Aristotle, Plato. And here I have been thinking that they were mine all along. Here I have been thinking that Aristotle, Plato, my Saul Bellow is reputed to have said, when the Zulu producer Tolstoy, I'll read him. And here I had been thinking that Tolstoy was mine. I didn't think the Zulu needed to produce one. I thought he belonged to the Zulu too if they chose to read him. Maybe the Zulu has something to teach us, and maybe it doesn't look like Tolstoy. Do you understand what I'm saying here? I'm talking about this notion that we're going to establish dignity by affirming the greatness of our culture and all this kind of business, this kind of nationalist, this kind of, I digress again. Are blacks a people? I'm going to say no. I'm not about sympathy for the position of struggling to regain honor or to gain honor and standing in a society and the extent to which that might tip one into the position that Du Bois ends up in. I mean, not only am I not without sympathy for it, I mean, I can give you a biographical line on this. I remember the Million Man March. This was the Million Man March of 1995. It was in the fall of 1995 on the mall in Washington, D.C., a man called Louis Farrakhan was the leader, yes, Louis Farrakhan of the Nation of Islam was the leader of what was called a Million Man March. Spike Lee made a little film about it called Get on the Bus, that I'm sure you can still get from your DVD rental place if anybody cares. Black men going to Washington, D.C. to affirm their responsibilities to their community. The Million Man March. Louis Farrakhan issued a call, and literally a million, or something very close to it, our I said, our BU's BU's remote sensing team. You know, when they look down and try to see stuff from satellites, and they tried to count the crowd there. They say it might have been 750,000. So let's give them a million. I mean, heck, a whole bunch of black men showed up in D.C. And I was among them. I was there a day early. I was covering the event for the New Republic. But I got swept up into it myself. I got drawn into it. I mean, there was a Washington Mall was crowded. I mean, there were three times as many people there as who were at the March on Washington. There were three times as many people answering Farrakhan's call for black manhood to affirm its responsibilities than who showed up in 1963 to hear Martin Luther King give that I Have a Dream speech. That's just a fact. So, I was there. I was among them. And I got swept up with it, too. They were beautiful black men. They were beautiful. They were well-behaved. It was amazing to see them. Made me think about my old Uncle Mooney. Made me think about Chicago. Made me regret being what I was at that time, but I am not anymore. I am proud to say a neoconservative. No. We can get into that, but that's another subject over here. It made me the call of the tribe. So seductive. We were going to do this thing. We, African-American men, were going to stand strong. We were going to protect our women and children. We were going to be prayerful and reverent. Great tradition, a great people, called to our tradition. Egypt, Ethiopia. My eyes were rolling back in my head. Right? It felt really good. It felt good to be in the crowd. It felt good to be swept up with black men affirming their manhood. Meanwhile, if I had a PowerPoint here, I could show you, because I got my UBS USB drive right here. I could show you all the slides. Number of black men in prison. Going up like that. The curve looks like, have you ever seen an exponential graph where they graph e to the x, how it goes up? You know, anybody in here can laugh in the philosophy department. Goes up, slope keeps getting steeper. That's what the number of black men in prison looks like. And guess what? It didn't slow down after 1995. Meanwhile, two out of every three African-American babies is born to a woman who is not married. You may think I am more moralizing. I am not. I'm not moralizing. I'm just reporting a fact. That number has not ticked down since 1995. Meanwhile, average black 17-year-old on math and reading tests administered by the Department of Education to a national representative sample test at about the same level of proficiency as white 13-year-olds on the average in this country. Today, 4 years difference in the acquired functioning among math and reading on the average today. So, numbers in prison going like this. The black family. Well, I guess we'd have to have a seminar on that, wouldn't we? Please don't get mad at me out there, anybody. I have a very complicated view of that issue. I am not simplistically blaming anybody. I understand that it's deep. But if two out of every three children are born to a woman without a husband, there are going to be some problems in the processes of human development for people in that community. That is a tremendous burden on the development of the potentiality of human beings in that community. Who can deny that? Okay, it's a problem. It's a problem. Now, whose problem is it? Black people's. Blacks have a problem. Why don't they clean up their act? You see, this is what I'm talking about. This is where I'm trying to go with this lecture. This is what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that people's talk, the language of talking in terms of peoples, the reliance upon this mythic construction of collectivity imposed upon a complex social and historical reality is dangerous, dangerous, dangerous political talk, because I'm here to tell you that the numbers of black men in prison going up like that is not a black people's problem. It's an American people's problem. It's not as if we were two countries situated on different sides of the universe having foreign relations with each other. There aren't any black people. Blacks don't pass any laws. Blacks don't raise any taxes. In the social sciences, which I hope some of you philosophers will take, they talk about collective action problems. That's a recognition of the deep strategic fact that what is in our interest together may not be in any one of our single interests to pursue. It's called the prisoner's dilemma in game theory. You know the idea. Each of us does the thing that seems beyond any calculation to be the best thing for me to do for myself. No matter what the other does, this is the best thing for me to do for myself. But when we all do it, we all end up much worse off than we might be if we had somehow been able to get ourselves coordinated around a more socially constructive action. Give any examples, but I don't have time. I assume you know this. A people. If they're going to be a people. And now I am being derisive because the point is so obvious as not to have to be stated, had better be able to solve some collective action problems. They better be able to get on the same page. They better have a boundary who's a people who's not be able to discipline it and enforce it. They better have rules that they can somehow inculcate in others. There better be consequences for members of the people not adhering to what the people say they're supposed to do. Otherwise, we're just throwing words around and we don't have any, we're not talking about anything. African Americans do not control the institutions that educate their children. I am merely stating a fact. They do not control the sensibilities inculcated in their children. They do not control the media, rap music, women are bitches and hoes and all this kind of stuff, and they're bad people with all this bad language. I'm here to tell you that there's a company called Time Warner, and there's a place called the Lexington Mall, and that a lot of rap music gets marketed by the company, and a lot of it gets bought at the mall. Talking billions here, people. Anybody can get on iTunes. I say it's a commercial product, it's a product of American culture. I say it has as much to do with white male adolescent rebellion in middle America as it has to do with bitches and hoes in the ghetto. It's a product. Blackness has been marketed. That's what rap music is about. That's what those videos are about. It's just a commercial product. It hasn't got anything to do with a people. It's Madison Avenue meets Hollywood meets the South Bronx. That's all it is. And it sells everywhere in the world. I've heard hip-hop done in Arabic. I've heard it done in Hindi. It hasn't got anything to do with a putative black people. There are no black people in that sense. It's about a global village. It's about telecommunications. It's about money. It's about celebrity. It's about style. Who's hip, what's in. And therefore, when we come to talking about the important matters that confront our country, like how many people are we going to lock up in prisons? Where are we going to put hospitals? Who's going to have access to health care? And how much are we going to spend on education? To pollute that sacred civic conversation about matters of the most fundamental ethical significance, which is how we're going to live together as an American people, to pollute that deliberation with reference to some kind of mythic, caricatured, stereotyped conception of peoplehood being imputed to blacks who have been in America for 10 generations. Just to make to make a conceptual error, and it's to make a moral error. Conceptual error is that you're analyzing in the wrong categories. You're talking about black culture when there really isn't any such thing. You're relying on anachronistic has-been rhetoric. America hasn't been black and white for a half century. I can just look at this room and see that. Old categories. Old stereotypes. When the issues before us are in the greatest nation on earth, in the most powerful country in the world, in the sole remaining superpower, in the richest country on earth, in the most free country on earth, you have the most hellish places you can imagine to live right in the center of our great cities. You have education systems teaching people who don't have any place else to go, and those people are not learning. And you've got more people corralled and locked up, more people's bodies being controlled by the coercive force of the state than any place else on the globe. In the land of the free, we've got 5 million people under the supervision of the state, and 2 million of them are in cells. Now, you want to talk to me about black culture? You want to talk to me about black crime? It is an offensive term. Why? Not because you've stepped over some politically correct line onto my little racial sensibility, but because you stick your head in the sand relative to a problem that affects each and every one of us. There's not any black crime in this country. All there is crime by desperate people, undeveloped people. Marginal people, excess people, human refuse people, neglected people, other people that we can't muster any sympathy for. That's what there is. There isn't any black crime. Those people happen to be black, often, not always, in America. But it's not as if there were a black people sending crime out from their little nation into the world. They are us. They're us. Those people are us. That's the conceptual error. The 15-year-old ghetto-dwelling, swaggering, gun-toting felon and thug is an American. He's an American failure. He's an American responsibility. And to make him into a black culture deviant is just to stick your head in the sand. It misconstrues the problem. It also is very convenient, isn't it? Because then you don't have to actually take any responsibility for the problem. Then you don't have to do anything. New Orleans. I mean, I could go into this game, and I realize that I'm shouting and I'm preaching. But I feel strongly about the matter. I feel strongly about the question of what are the terms on which this political community, I talk now about the United States of America, going to conduct our public deliberations about the matters of the most vital interest and concern, having to do with our mutual responsibilities one to the other, having to do with what we do with people who fail in our society, having to do with what are we going to do to help those who need help, and to conduct that conversation in a racialized discourse, to talk about African-American peoplehood, and I'm making a political point now, instead of American peoplehood, to say, as so many are saying, and I can cite them, if blacks would just get their acts together, if they would just clean up their acts, if they would just get control of their communities. The means in prison, the meaning of a community like North Philadelphia, like the west side of Chicago, like South Central LA, like much of Camden, New Jersey, like Southeast Washington, D.C., like Central Baltimore, the meaning of those physical realities. These are ongoing and functioning organic communities in the middle of the United States of America. They are a century old. When African Americans begin to migrate out of the South and out off the farm and into the industrial heartlands of the country and into the North and the Northeast, they were segregated into these ghettoized communities really quite consciously. books, great books, have been written about this dynamic. Thomas Sugrue's book about Detroit, The Origins of the Urban Crisis, is one. There were fights about where the housing projects would be, about how a wall would be built along the boundary of a subdivision financed by federal money in order to make sure that the blacks couldn't move across the wall so easily, and such. Political candidacies were made and careers were built on saying, I'll keep your neighborhood safe from them. I'm talking about in 1950. In 1950, a Republican was elected mayor of Detroit. Can you imagine it? That is the city of the United Auto Workers. It's a Democratic town in 1950. I'm not talking about George Wallace, 1972. I'm not talking about Richard Nixon. I'm not talking about Ronald Reagan. I'm talking about 1950. The Nazis had just been defeated. A Republican was elected mayor of Detroit saying, I won't let the niggers move into your neighborhood, basically. Not those words, that was the argument. I'll keep them out. So these places, South Central LA, the east side of Detroit, the west side of Chicago, they didn't just fall from the sky. They're not just the effusion of some corrupted people who don't have good values. This is not something that blacks did to America. They went head down, so how could they have done that to us? This is us. This is us. This is the American state. This is the American economy and the American society. These are products of our collective making. When we built the interstate, when we moved to the suburb, when we hired more police, when we cut the budget this way, when we sited the public housing and built a 14-story side on a few acres instead of letting them live throughout the city, we made these ghettos, each and every one of us. It's an American product. This people talk simply evades the historical reality and the political and moral responsibility to come to grips with what we have wrought in this country. We, all of us. So now, I don't credit people's talk. Not unless the people that we're talking about are the American people. Because insofar as we're talking about black Americans, that's the only people.
I'll work on that.
Maybe I'll ask the first question. Professor Lowry, I wonder if from the point of view of justice, part of why it doesn't make sense to talk of the black people is that that's the kind of people that that's not very easy to opt out of. And if you can't opt out of the classification, it seems to create a problem for it. In other words, I'm Jew, but I can very easily say that I'm Jewish, but I can very easily say that I'm not.
Well, do you mean that the person can't evade having others see them in that light because their visible presentation marks them in a certain way?
Right.
So what I don't understand about your question is why you think the ability or not to avoid being perceived by outsiders as a member of a group is critical to establishing whether or not it's sensible to talk about there being a group.
Does it negate your possibility to choose to belong to the group?
And why is the choice of belonging? Well, but that's a different question.
In other words, if there was a real, here's a reformulation of the question, if there was a real choice of belonging to black people, would you be more comfortable with? If there wasn't more...
No, because my objections are not, because as I said, I wasn't really trying to, sort of examine the factual question of whether or not blacks are people is moral, but that's not inconsistent with what you're saying, I see. But my objection is that the talk about blacks as a people it's not the liberty of some individual that I'm concerned that they're going to somehow be forced to be either in or not in a group that they don't want to be in. It's that I guess I didn't make this clear. I guess I didn't say this. May I have the opportunity to say it now? What I want to say is that it's that when we think about sort of what the structure of our social relations are, these invented categories that we are just sort of layering on top of them actually affect our cognition. They affect the way we process information and what we see. They cause us to come to different conclusions than we might otherwise come to. I tried to give examples, but perhaps I didn't put the emphasis in the right place. So the problem with rap music is not that there are some people with bad values who are producing a commercial product. I mean, if you surf the porn on the internet, you know that there are people with bad values who are producing commercial products. And they're mostly, I'm not recommending that, I'm just saying. Supply creates its own demand. I mean, demand creates its own supply is what I meant to say in this case. I mean, it's the fact that people want these services that are trying to thing out. It's the same thing with drugs. It's the fact that people... So if we see the cultural pollution of bad values from the ghetto in hip-hop, or if we see in the drug trade indisciplined young men who are out there on the streets destroying our youth by trafficking in drugs, we misunderstand the problem. It's us. We're the problem, if there's a problem, the extent to which there's a problem. We're the problem with drugs. We're the problem. If you look at drug consumption statistics, they're very ecumenical by class and by race. Everybody is getting high, not in this room, but elsewhere in America, evidently, everybody's getting high. So drugs are not something that the Colombians or the Afghanis or the hooded sweatshirt, sneaker-wearing, backward cap-turning ghetto youth have inflicted on us. The problem lies here. So that's what I'm concerned about. I'm concerned about a categorization of society, in this case, a racial categorization with the imputation of peoplehood and the responsibilities and capacities attendant thereto. Why don't they clean up their act? To blacks, why don't blacks clean up their act? That kind of rhetoric. As if blacks could act! Come on, it's a first order point. Blacks, as such, can't act! Let me repeat, there's not a private space. There's not some secret language. It's not like we got a bunch of handshakes over here. There isn't any independent cultural development. It's all symbiotically intertwined. We're intermarried up the wazoo. To call myself an African American, I have to lop off huge branches of the family tree. Those are the Europeans and the Native Americans who are partly of my ancestors. I have to just not remember them. We don't elect our leaders. We can't discipline anybody. We can't hold Jesse Jackson accountable or Reverend Al Sharpton for anything they do. CNN will take them to be acting in our name. They will gin up anti-black sentiment that will lead to another 10,000 going to prison by putting on the buffoonish Reverend Al Sharpton and then having... one of these cable guys, I don't remember their names, I wonder why, say, oh, see what they're up to now? And then another 100,000 voters in Alabama go, that's a Republican vote. We don't control what Al Sharpton does. Nobody elects him. He's not a black leader. That's a ridiculous phrase. It's ridiculous. Nobody elected him. He's not accountable to anybody. Nobody gets the same thing about what he says. How does he get to be my leader? Because CNN decided that he was my leader. And you people believe them. There aren't any black people. They're just Americans here. That's what I'm saying.
So I'm wondering about solutions. I mean, given the problems, I understand what you're saying. I'm wondering, is what's called for about the different change in public morality?
I want out of the race thing altogether. And I'm not a colorblinder. I'm not saying I'm against affirmative action. I know that I'm black, okay, all this kind of stuff. I'm not a self-hating Negro. I want out of the race thing. We got American problems here. I want the 50, the New York Times carried this story maybe 18 months ago, 2 years ago. There are more persons in Florida state prisons for life without the possibility of parole committed their offenses when they were juveniles. That are being held in a similar way by all the other countries in the world combined. That was the bottom line of the New York Times article. They did a survey. There's some in Israel, I guess they're Palestinians. There's some in South Africa, there's some in China. Maybe a few other places in the world, hold juvenile offenders in prison for life without the possibility of being released. They're locked up for life without the possibility of parole by law. There's 1,400 of them in Florida. 1,400 of them. So, I'm saying that those kids are our failure. They're not just, it's not just on them, it's also on us. That's what I'm saying about those kids. They've done terrible things. I mean, if they're locked up for life without the possibility of parole, the chances are that they didn't shoot, they were there participating in the robbery when somebody was shot, or whatever. These are terrible things. I'm not saying they ought to be punished. I'm not saying that at all. But we've given up on those people. They can't possibly be us. We have no sympathy for them. It's not as if they're our kid. It's not as if we look at it and see the societal tragedy that it is. A 15-year-old on the street with a pistol in his hand is a social failure. No matter what, I am not unmindful of the imperative of personal responsibility. I understand the problem, the Kantian problem. I'm in a philosophy department. I understand the problem that we have to assume agency if we're going to have moral theory, even though the circumstances well may be determinative in some sense, and we can't ignore the pressures of society, and yet we still have to hold persons responsible, otherwise we have no morality. I see that. Even an economist can see that. But that's not my point. I'm not talking about the morality of the offender. I'm talking about social morality. I'm talking about what we then do, what we do, what we do together. And the locking up and throwing away the key on 15-year-olds in the hundreds upon hundreds is a collective act, and it's not befitting of a great state. I mean, I would argue that it's not, I don't think it can stand scrutiny upon close ethical examination, upon close social ethical examination. So it's the inability of people to see that. To see that in part because these are others, they're very threatening others, and they've been demonized. These kids have been demonized. Have you heard of the super predator? Google it. Google super predator. And a whole literature will come out from the late 1980s and the early 1990s of Princeton professors writing knowledgeable articles about the coming super predator. Now, mind you, crime has fallen through the 90s like this. It's fallen straight down. Crime has fallen precipitately during the 90s. Prison numbers have gone like that. And in 1990, 91, 92, 93, all us professors were writing, super predators coming to get your mama. Thugs. The crack wars were killing black men on the streets of all the big cities and Hispanics. Those were the crack wars. The murder rate for them went like this, but not for you and me. We were safe behind our fences. But we continue to lock them up and throw away the key because we can't see their humanity, because they've been demonized, because they've been made to an other. This people talk is dangerous nonsense, I insist. They are not an other. They are our children. I'm talking about the ones who do not speak English, who are dark of skin, and who live in hellish places that nobody wants to go. They're our children. We are one people. I'm repeating myself. That's my.
Yes. You mentioned one Republican in the 50s in Detroit. I don't remember his name.
Yeah, I didn't know. I don't remember his name either.
Doesn't matter. Of course, all those places that you did mention, where we have widespread black crime, racism. But I mean,
I'll put it pretty confidently.
All right. They're all Democratic. Democratic politicians that control the cities. I don't know much about you, but in building you before I came, you have plenty of experience with both sides of the political spectrum. You haven't mentioned politics once tonight today. I guess the premise of the, if I may, in quotations, given Iran against us because we don't think of these people as ours, every massive social problem program that I can think of has been initiated by Republicans, and they've been stopped by the leftists. The enterprise zones, tuition schools, you see, so the inner city schools that are democratically controlled. Is it not true that the black constituency in this country, if they stopped voting 90 to 95% for Democrats, could have a major impact by voting in Republicans? Now, maybe that wouldn't be a good thing, but there is a little bit of power to overlook. We can talk about politics. As my colleague said, we want to talk about solutions.
Let me not lose focus on the question. The question is, Democrat, Republican, let's talk about politics. Republicans interview program 7. I definitely want to deal with the question, but I must. I'm in a philosophy department. I must have objected in a very friendly way. And not only you. I mean, let's not talk about problems, let's talk about solutions. Not every problem has a solution. And maybe it does and nobody knows what it is. And you can't find any solution to a problem without talking about a problem. My whole point was, we misdiagnosed the problem. That was my argument. I could be wrong about it, but that was what I was trying to argue. I was trying to say, we project these categories of peopleness, and we talk about this autonomous black people over here, and we tell them to do things, and we react to how they are. When in fact, all that's a fiction in our heads, not really something that's objectively given in the nature of society. So that was my argument. Okay, so that's why talking about problems and not solutions, because I think it's very important to understand the problem. But I do want to respond to your thing. Go ahead, I'll give you a chance to say.
But you make these lovely comments. You understand that we have to give more responsibility to the individual. So when somebody does a terrible crime, he's a black man, he doesn't have to
go to prison for life if he's a juvenile. Other countries in the civilized world where they also acknowledge personal responsibility, the prison sentences are anywhere near as long as what we're talking about. You don't have to lock somebody up for life because they've taken another life. That's something that you can make a decision about.
Yes, but what does the black community that are crying, that are not oriented towards crime, want that person to do? He doesn't want to come back in 5 years. If we could rehabilitate in prisons, that would be another matter. That's something we should talk about.
Yeah, okay, we should
talk. But from listening to what you say, you would draw the conclusion, well, there's too much emphasis on a police function in the state. And then to get back to the same politics, that's even the Republicans. Get harder on crime, it's the Democrats who say, no, crime is a result of racism.
Well,
crime is because of poverty.
Okay, let's talk about
poverty. So you're talking politics and empathy, but you're not coming out and saying it.
No, okay, so let me do that.
So is it primarily a Republican party or a Democratic problem that is creating?
Okay, I will respond to that. Let me give Terry a chance.
Yeah, let's just bring it back to the point. But I wanted to focus on this notion of a dominant discourse, but I lost my point. But what I want to talk about is in terms of the discourse on problems and also solutions, how about prevention? How about
Okay. So politics, and I think you're right that I have been basically making a political argument by indirection and not taking responsibility. So I'm a Democrat. I'm on the Democratic side of the aisle. I'm on the quote liberal side of the aisle relative to conservatives. And when I think about politics, I don't accept what you said. I disagree with you fervently. I think enterprise zones are nothing. I don't think enterprise zones have anything to do with solving the problems in cities. I mean, tax breaks for companies may generate a little bit of employment, but you can't create real long-term economic independence in that way, in my opinion. I think it's something around the edges of the thing. But not to get down into concrete policies too quickly, I want to take a bigger overlook. What I think happened in this country is that Lyndon Johnson, a great man, in the 1960s, that's when we really had social programs. This little enterprise zone stuff is just something to try to do something on the cheap. We try to get a little private sector thing going on over here, but we're not dealing with anything fundamental. I'm talking about federal aid to education. That was created in the 1960s. Federal aid to education, I don't think anybody's against it. Medicare. As far as I can tell, everybody's for that everywhere I look. That was created in the 1960s. A lot of programs didn't work, and didn't work very well. Urban renewal didn't work very well. Public housing, I think most people have to say, didn't work very well. Community development block grants, maybe it's a mixed record.
AFDC.
Yeah, the AFDC was reformed. It was reformed with a Republican Congress and a Democratic president in the 1990s. But it went up a lot in the 1960s, and it was a problem. It became a problem, especially for those who were on for long-term dependency. But the thing that I would say about politics and race and the blacks' peoplehood, I mean, I've been accused of not being transparent in my politics, but I think the Republicans can be accused for a quarter century of not being transparent in their politics, of playing to the resentment of whites to the fundamental transformation of social relations in this country that took place in the 1960s. I'm not only talking about the civil rights movement. I'm talking about black power. And I'm talking about riots. Now, there were riots. American cities were burning. It happened summer after summer after summer. It wasn't pretty, and it was not a good thing, and it terrified a lot of people. And it gave a sense of disquiet, of things spinning out of control. I'm talking about a country that was in a very controversial war. I'm talking about a president assassinated in 1963, and his brother shot dead in 1968, and the national leader of the civil rights movement murdered with a telescopic weapon in 1968, and Malcolm X and Black Power forced busing. Okay, Supreme Court trickles down, lower courts, back up to the Supreme Court, trickles down, bounces around. 15 years after Brown, you actually get some action on the ground. Now, Brooklyn is in danger. We're going to have community control of schools, and some teachers are going to get not any longer in control of their jobs. Right? And hamlets and towns all over the country are in danger. And there's a Supreme Court case. It doesn't happen until 1975 when the court finally says that you can't force a suburban school district to merge with a central city school district in order to create equality of educational opportunity in a metropolitan area, as long as you can't prove that the suburban district was complicit with the city school district in racial discrimination. If you could prove that, you could, but if you can't, you can't. Which means that we're safe in Brooklyn. Thank God. I thought that was supposed to be sarcasm. What I'm saying is, I was accused, and I think rightly, of not having made my political agenda transparent. But I think the racial agenda of the Republican Party for a quarter of a century is something that has also not been made transparent, but that is real. Johnson said when he signed the Civil Rights Act, I'm giving away the South for a generation. The truth is he gave away the South forever in 1965. The South was lost to Democrats forever in 1965. And all this talk about affirmative action, and about, we've got a Republican candidate running for governor now. I saw the headline in the Boston Herald. Y'all didn't think I read the Boston Herald. I saw the headline in the Boston Herald this morning. The Democrats are whining, says the Boston Herald, because the Republican who's running for governor called the black man, who's a Democrat, who's running for governor, soft on crime. Even Tom Riley says, she says, he's soft on crime. But I remember Willie Horton. I remember 1988. I remember when the governor of this commonwealth was running for the president of the United States, and because he had endorsed a humane program of allowing the furlough of people from prisons, and one of those people did something awful. A man called Lee Atwater and his minions, who were Republicans, whose business was to get Republicans elected, made a symbol out of this thing and put it pendant to Michael Dukakis, and it stuck. Revolving door of the prison. Black thug gonna come and get your mama, and Michael Dukakis is gonna let him out. Now, the president of the United States has very little control over how anybody gets out of anybody's prison. That's what states do. I mean, there's a federal prison system, but it's less than 1/10 of the total. So it was all BS, but it worked. I remember that Ronald Reagan started his campaign in 1980 in Philadelphia, Mississippi. I know Ralph Reed. I know him. I know what these people are about. I'm sorry that I repair to stereotypic verbiage. I mean to say these people are differentiated. They're individual human beings. They're not all alike, coming with stamps on their foreheads. I understand that. But they get their candidates elected in this country by mining the very deep well of racial resentment. So I used to be a Republican, and I almost went to work for Ronald Reagan, and these people who were writing articles about super predators were friends of mine. I changed my mind because I became convinced that the Republican intellectuals, at least the ones that I, the neocons and the now influential people that I used to hang out with, were more interested in using the blacks as an emblem of the failure of some ideological left that they had imagined than they weren't actually knowing or helping any one of those people. So I just did.
I'm better than any black person or any Latino. I think they're all equal to me. Does that mean that I am not racist, or there are other ways that I can be racist?
That's a charming question. I mean it really without any irony. But in some sense, it's an innocent question. Because you set yourself up. I've already shown myself capable of praying, so you set yourself up. I can have at you, but I won't.
Please
I'm,
do.
No. I'm gonna. Well,
I was.
Of course not. Of course, it doesn't mean that you're not a racist. Of course not. I mean, it doesn't mean that you are. I mean, I haven't said you were a racist. That's not what I was trying to say. But of course, this etiquette of, I think all people are equal. When the things that I'm talking about are about power. And they're about the structure of society. So an individual person's sentiments in regard to what they might think about another person wouldn't keep me. I mean, it would. I was searching for an analogy, but I don't think that's the right move. I don't think that's the right move. I don't like the word racist because I think it's very imprecise. And in my book, The Anatomy of Racial Inequality, I have a discussion about exactly that point. I'm not going to use the word racist, I say. I say I'm interested in understanding the deeper structures of power and inequality in the society. And racist is an epithet. It's something that we throw at people. We make them bad. We make the problem into a problem of the individual's morality when the problem is a problem of social morality. Okay. So, when... I say to a person, the government is inefficient and it's wasting your money. Look, there's a welfare queen. And the picture in the newspaper is of a black woman who was overweight and not very well-dressed with 6 children around her, shown getting a welfare queen. And then somebody picks up the newspaper and they look at that photograph and they say, darn those people. And down in their subconscious, the blackness of that woman in the larger number of those children and her being a little roly-poly and all triggers some subconscious psychological thing and just convinces you that this is the worst possible use of public monies ever. And so you go to the voting booth and you vote with the lever on, well, Republican. I'm just kidding. I'm teasing my friend up here. Plenty of Democrats run on the same stuff. You go and you pull the lever for the guy who says, I want to cut off the money to these lazy-bone women. Now, are you a racist? You well might say, oh, I think a black person is as good as anybody else. You know, but you still might pull the lever, right? I mean, what would be the point of me getting into a kind of examination of your etiquette? I mean, the real problem is people run for office by playing to the visceral reactions and fears of other people, and that in a society which is deeply racialized, the images in the back of a person's mind just beneath the surface that the advertisers and the political campaigners know how to access have racial aspects to them. It's the society then, wouldn't it be? And the institutions that would be quote racist, close quote, and your participation in them to the extent that you did would leave you as a part of quote the problem, close quote. But I mean that's something that I think is probably sort of, you know, wagging my finger in your face and saying, oh no, sanitize your thinking and have black friends. Am I responding to you?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean I just wanted to like acknowledge that racism is not just an individual problem, it's a societal problem.
Yeah, that's really not what I was saying. Let's go here. Yeah.
I wonder if you could comment on the following set of ideas. You sort of walk up to the edge of something and you back away because you don't like people talk, and your critique of people talk as far as African Americans. Powerful and living quality. And yet, you fully adopt American people.
Yeah.
And it's a little understanding yet, the thing about peoplehood, I think, is that it's wishing makes it so. And the notion of American is a powerful idea. Wishing makes it so, and it's that's a reality that comes from that. So your critique of African Americanness is both is a critique of you're preventing the wish, and therefore you're destroying the people as you prevent the wish. And my own feeling is that the critique you have for African American people, there's no clear way in which you could stop and not extend it to American people. But as you talked about Al Sharpton not being elected, I ideally substituted George Bush. I understand that you constantly, you did make reference to the institutions which were important for people.
Yeah, the Internal Revenue Service.
That's
how you put an army on the ground in Iraq.
But it's more than that. In fact, the mythic qualities of the people are very important for American people.
No, I agree. I think it's a wonderful question. I mean, I'm not unmindful, but I didn't, that there is this tension, and I used to feel it very much when I was a pro-black peoplehood person, because I thought, what do I say to the Native Americans? Frederick Douglass, the great evangelist, he was an evangelist, actually, abolitionist, 19th century figure, he gave this speech called Who's 4th of July, and in 1852, something like that. It was early in the 50s. And it was before the Dred Scott decision. And Douglass was very exercised by all that was going on, of course. And he was trying to say, why should the Negro celebrate the 4th of July when the 4th of July is the white guys celebrating a mythic revolution that they don't really want to apply the principles for to all people. We hold these truths to be self-evident, blah, blah, blah. Okay, so that's Frederick Douglass. But Mills, Charles Mills, the philosopher at Illinois, the racial contract, this is a philosopher. He argues that, in an essay somewhere, he argues that, well, Frederick Douglass is up there talking about how black people haven't gotten the freedom, but what about the Native Americans who are being, pushed west and off and west and routed and off and routed all across the land, even as he's talking, and there's no space in his, and when I read that, I thought that was a profound insight, and I thought it applies in our time. I mean, that is to say, that Douglass's construction of the nation in this black and white had left out the red, and by making the question of justice the way that he made it, which was, why don't you guys recognize what the founding was about and include us in it, he didn't even make any mention of the Native Americans or something back there, and he just put them out. But then he ought to be arguing from a larger perspective, and when African Americans confront questions like immigration, and like competition, those very same, it seems to me, those, some of those similar questions, because our argument is parasitic on a presumption of American nationalism, which might be problematic in certain circumstances. So, I would fall back on practicality. I would fall back on saying, you got the Internal Revenue Service, so you can raise taxes. You got the Congress of the United States, and you got a legitimate and accepted system of the educational laws. So you can enact you can have the power of the state come to bear in solving your collective action problems in various ways. I mean, you say you didn't vote for George Bush, which of course is not an argument because the guy can win 51-49 and you didn't vote for him, but he's still the president. But I think you're implying that not a majority of the people voted for George Bush and that maybe he stole the election in 2000, and that could be true, I don't know. But the Supreme Court, and I mean, what are you going to do? Nation of law is not dead. I mean, he was duly elected by the Supreme Court as president of the United States in 2000. I mean, what are you going to do? So I don't think blacks, I know you agree with me about that, going on to the American thing.
Yes, I just going to say that whatever institutions you can mention as far as American institutions go, they are rooted in myths. That is to say, we listen to the Supreme Court, or we listen to elections, and they never, majority of situations, we act as if they are. So myth is woven through all these.
So myth wouldn't on its own be enough to jettison the idea of the but myth and the service of this particular people that are arguing is
misogyny. That's right. Religion is a good example. Religion, the mythic dimensions of religion, is tremendous power, whether or not there's a God. Religion plays a big role.
You talked about the power that the Million Man March had on you
small question. Do you recommend experiences like that occurring, given the fact that you, as one of many of the million men that participated in that, had a positive experience that for you was a growth experience? Do you think that that was a good thing to have happen? Would you recommend other experiences where people who are black get together and experience
what I think is that conversion is the least of it, and discipleship is the issue. If I'm going to put it in kind of churchy terms, right? A person comes to the revival meeting, all right, and Billy Sunday or whoever, Billy Graham or whatever is up there preaching, and get Jesus, you start bouncing around, and you want to get saved. Okay, within the Christian and American culture, this kind of plan. Okay? So then you're saved. Okay, so there's that wonderful feeling. You're on the mall, there's a million men, the crowd is roaring, there's that wonderful feeling of conviction. But what happens the next day, and the next day, and the next day, and the day after that, and those following days? Now, how could I be against building institutions on the ground in communities to care for wayward children, to inspire cultural creativity, to praise God in whatever form, as it might develop amongst a people who are black? I can't, on a day-to-day, week-to-week, month-to-month, year-after-year basis. I'm going to adopt some children, a family might say, who don't have parents. Don't tell me what the out-of-wedlock birth rate is, what the abortion rate is, and what the giving up kids for adoption rate is. I don't care. I'm going to save this one. I'm going to adopt some. And I'm going to try to persuade my friends to it. I'm going to try to get a movement to it, because there should be a home for every kid. And there should be a home for every black kid, I can imagine somebody saying, or every Catholic kid, or every Jewish kid. Right? How are you going to be against that? Okay. So you ask me, should the Million Man March have happened? Given what happened after Million Man March, no. In the sense that it was all about conversion and not at all about discipleship. In the sense that it was just a show. There wasn't any institution. There isn't any institution. There isn't any legacy. There isn't any structure. There isn't any development. Right? If to motivate people to act in order to create the institutions to facilitate human development, I have to appeal to their myths, including their racial myths, I'm quite willing to do so. I'd be willing to do so in a church basement. But on the mall in Washington, in the National Shrine, when we talk about the people of the country and its governmental institutions and all that entails, I would very strongly rather, that they not be framed in racial terms. So my bottom line on the mall was that I was in this sway. I mean, I was like Du Bois with my eyes rolling in the back of my head and sphinxes with, you know, images of triumphant whatever. It was all some kind of romantic whatever. And what I realized is that the bottom line is that the institutions march forward. The political program marches forward. The huge and important decisions like War and Peace march forward. And those are the things that a state and a people are, I think, supposed to be negotiating. The American people, so I'm back to my argument.
I keep using it here. I'm really delighted that you brought up minstrelship and things like that.
Yeah.
When I teach my class in American music, you know, I go to the Library of Congress website, I show students the sheet music covers. I show them the addresses on the covers, which demonstrate that in the mid-19th century, the neighborhood right around us is the heart of the musical community.
Wow.
Turning this stuff out. I find students, more than anything else, are extraordinarily resistant to the idea that their musical life today has anything at all to do with that future. The idea that Eminem today or Mick Jagger in the 60s had anything to do with the musical tradition.
Wow.
Suggest that to the students, and totally will not accept that. Very few exceptions. So I'm glad you brought that up, because I think that there is a thread connecting all of that.
Thank you.
Just a follow-up to Dean Greenberg's question.
Yes.
Are you saying that the necessary sufficient conditions of peoplehood is capacity to be the subject of collective action problems, or to be an autonomous system?
Yeah, I'm kind of hitting at it. As I said when I started out, I didn't come with like a theory of peoplehood, and then I was going to say, okay, if peoplehood requires ABC, but blacks only had A, so they're not. That was not the line I was taking. I was taking a different line. This is an important question. I realize that's, you know, if I were a philosopher, that would be the way that I would be trying to do it. So no, I'm not saying necessary and sufficient. I'm saying necessary. What I'm saying is that if you don't have the capacity to act collectively, and yet you talk collectively, there will be a disjunction between your rhetoric and what it is that could actually happen, and that could lead to grave error. I think that's kind of what I'm saying. So I leave to further scholarship the question of, you know, what is a people and what is the place of collective action in that. But what I'm saying at a maybe a little bit lower level of practicality is that in this discourse of, oh, they are a people, why don't they do this? Well, you just missed something there. You assume they had the capacity to do this. Like I say, I think it's ridiculous to call Al Sharpton a black leader, although I know there's no way that I can stop anybody from calling him that, because he's black and he's a leader, okay? So he's a black leader. I mean, you can say that. But what I'm saying is what Bill O'Reilly or somebody means when he puts on Al Sharpton as a black leader is not that he's black or that he's a leader. He means that he symbolizes somehow action by a collectivity or a collective sensibility that can lead to action in one way or another, which I think is a fiction.
All right, I think we should start wrapping up because it's 5:30. There will be a reception right after. We can talk a little more informally.